That was a little bit of Bridge into the New Age, the title track from saxophonist Azar Lawrence's debut album, which originally came out in 1974 and was reissued late last year. Azar Lawrence is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which as of this episode is part of the OSIRIS Network, so if you're hearing the show for the first time, welcome. OSIRIS is a growing community of music and culture podcasts connecting music fans with conversation, commentary, and of course, lots of music. Check out osirispod.com for more great podcasts, and don't forget to visit burningambulance.com for articles, reviews, and more about the kind of music we discuss on this show. And if you want to support us on Patreon, that's fantastic. We're at patreon.com/burningambulance. Azar Lawrence is from Los Angeles and got his start playing with Horace Tapscott's Pan-African People's Orchestra. After that, he was in Elvin Jones's band, and then by the time he was 21, he had moved over to McCoy Tyner's group. He's on the Enlightenment, Samalayuka, and Atlantis albums. And while he was still doing that, he was invited to audition for Miles Davis's group with Pete Cozy, Reggie Lucas, Michael Henderson, the whole electric band that you hear on Agarda and Get Up With It and those records. Except Azar's audition took place live on stage at Carnegie Hall. You can actually hear him on the second disc of the Dark Magus album. He wound up not joining Davis's band, though, and stayed with McCoy Tyner for a few more years. He's also worked with Earth, Wind, and Fire, and has made about a dozen albums under his own name, including his debut, which you heard a little bit of, and his newest release, Elementals. I'm going to play another piece of music. This is a version of Walk Spirit, Talk Spirit from his 2010 album Mystic Journey. Now, this is a song that he originally recorded with McCoy Tyner on Enlightenment in 1973, but this is a reworking of it that he did with Eddie Henderson on trumpet and Rashid Ali on drums, among other people. So listen to a little bit of that, and then afterward you'll hear my interview with Azar Lawrence.
Thank you. The first song that was released from this new album is L.A. Bossa. Now, you've done a lot of stuff with Brazilian rhythms over the years, so what about that attracts you as a player?
It's interesting that just as a location, a lot of the new ideas are coming out of Brazil, and will be as the Aquarian Age gets rolling more and more as we get more into the new era. Then the ideas, the fresh new ideas of humanity, as a one, as oneness, and all of that type of thing will come out of Brazil, and even New York is in the zone that if you take a look at the Earth in its astrological zones as it's broken down in some charts, even New York is in that zone, but Brazil is, is directly a direct hit on the so-called zone of Aquarius. So I just found myself being attracted to the Brazilian / Afro Brazilian rhythms. I mean, because, of course, a lot of the captives that didn't want to remain captive and were successful in their escape landed in the South Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the rhythms, were out of the, are even in a more pure state, shall I say, not more than others, but it just has a concentration. In the South Americans, and that kind of does strike a tone within me and many others. So that, that's where that came from. And also, a close friend, associate, and mentor, McCoy Tyner, the 5.5 years that I spent in his mentorship, I was able to see the results of utilizing those rhythms, which he used many of, in songwriting and playing some of the same type of previously referred to as jazz, type of lingo, mm-hmm. vocabulary in those contexts.
I know there was a lot of that on that Sama La Yuca record. Was that the first time that you had worked in that style? Was with was on that record?
Not really. I mean, I was familiar with those rhythms,
mm-hmm.
just in my growth. Just even as fundamentally as the learning of "Girl from Ipanema," everybody had to know that one.
Okay, sure.
But,
yeah,
as you're coming up, Sergio Mendes and his Brazil 66 in the six, and all of those type of things were favorites of mine. And again, I was drawn to those type of rhythms as a preferred listening. But McCoy used them even more so than my liberator from stagnation, or I don't even want to say it like that, but Elvin Jones, who took me out of L.A. and on the official road, as we should, we'll call it, mm-hmm. on the upper echelon of the musical genre, jazz. We used some. We had a song called Antigua. We had a few songs that were of that type of rhythmic foundation, but McCoy leaned, used them quite often, a lot of the songs. That type of thing. Yeah, Solomon Yuka certainly did focus on that, didn't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now you've worked with Elvin Jones first, and then when McCoy hired you for his band, you were, what, about 21? So
yeah, you got it. I think I was about 21.
So how did you come onto those guys' radar at all? Like, how did you get those gigs?
Well, interesting how that happened. Benny Golson's son, Reggie Golson, and I met through Horace Tapscott when I was performing with Horace Tapscott and the big band. And I had just... Well, I was still in high school, actually, because on Sundays we had these free concerts at over at a high school, Fosse High.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's Fosse's a junior high, middle school. Yeah, over at Fosse, so the auditorium there, and there was a gathering of quite a few great artists, John Carter, Bobby Bradford. They would open the set, and then the big band, the Horace Tapscott Orchestra, we would perform, Arthur Blythe, Horace, and Nate Morgan, and, you know, it was a lot of greats there, but and it attracted, you know, a lot of the serious listeners and, you know, are also musicians. And so I met Reggie Golson, who has passed on, rest his soul, some years ago, but Reggie became, we were best of friends, and I was at the Golson homestead daily with Reggie. I mean,
mm-hmm.
And so through him, he and he had a set. He was a drummer and had a set of Elvin's drums. And he would tell, boy, he brought me. He had such a collection of music and records. And he, that's what we would do. He was taking me through blindfold tests. I mean, he was playing all kind of music that I wasn't familiar with. And I mean, all the latest. You know, John Coltrane, Albert Eiler, you name it. You know, Herbie Hancock, Sonny Rollins. I mean, all of it. And then he was telling me, you know, about the episodes when he was on the road with Duke Ellington and in the bus. And his father just told me about 2 years ago when we were hanging out. He was saying that, oh yeah, Reggie knew Duke Ellington even. More, you know, was closer to Duke than he was, than Benny himself was.
Wow. You
know, something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah. And anyway, so Elvin came to town to play at this great club called the Lighthouse, and I rode with Reggie. Reggie, come on, let's go pick up Elvin and his wife, Keiko. So we went out there, and you know, and to this day, I do not know how he did it. He had a Volkswagen Bug. Did he have the Bug, or did he have the station wagon at the time? I think he had the Bug, man. We got Elvin and his drum set and luggage in that Bug and the four of us and drove somehow. But yeah, oh man, at any rate, that was how I first met Elvin. And Dave Liebman had left Elvin to join Miles, and I wasn't aware of that, but I guess Reggie spoke to Elvin and I told him, yeah, man, he's our man, this guy's the guy. And so we went out that night to the club and to listen to Elvin, and I brought my soprano just in case something, you know, Reggie, man, bring your horn in case something happened. I said, okay. So then Elvin walked up behind me and said, all right, you might get a chance to use that thing. So I was like, oh, shoot, maybe I will sit in. But no, he didn't call me up there, but the, afterwards they asked me to if I had time to make a rehearsal the next day. Well, I said, of course I do. And, you know, I went there and played one song with them, Steve Grossman, Gene Perla in mm-hmm. the hotel. And I was packing up like, thanks, guys. Man, that was nice. You know, and he was like, you with me, ain't you? He said, you with me, ain't you? He said, I got a plane ticket for you. I was like, oh, yes, I am, my friend. But actually, before that, we walked across the street. The hotel is on Vine, right next to where the Musicians Union was, and across the street from the Professional Drum Shop. And he said, well, come on, walk across the street with me. So we went over there, and we went to the drum shop. And he got some sticks and stuff, and he said, oh, meet my new saxophonist. And I was like, we hadn't even played a note yet. he hadn't heard me at all. And he said, yeah, that's my new tenor saxophonist. I was like, man, that was an honor. But anyway, so after that, and then, you know, Steve and Gene said, oh, you don't want to stay. Because they said, well, come stay with us. We're going to adopt you. you know, and okay. And so, but Steve Grossman and Gene said, oh, you don't want to stay with him. We have a place up here, up in Harlem that, you know, that you can stay there. We don't use it, but every now and then. I said, okay. And so I went up there and they let me in. I didn't have a key or anything. They just left me in this place. We'll see you tomorrow. So, okay. I was in there and boy, it was ridiculously filthy. I remember, the bed and the sheets had been slept on for years and never changed. I mean, it was ridiculous. But at any rate, the next day I propped the door open, went out and made a telephone call and, called Elvin and they said, come on down here. We told you to come here. So I went on down there and I moved in with Elvin and Keiko. And for 2.5 years, I lived with them and, I rejoined him after McCoy.
Yeah.
And then before Miles or somewhere in there. But at any rate, so that's how Elvin and, they just, I was part of the family. And we would rehearse right there. And my bedroom was overlooking the Central Park because it was on Central Park West and he had all his drums and all different drum sets in there and stuff. So we would rehearse in that same room. But it was quite an experience. And what happened is Alphonse Muzan, or Recisso, was such a large part of the whole thing, of the scheme of things, because I had always wanted to play with McCoy Tyner. I was just, from a chordal standpoint, just musically. I mean, of course, Elvin was playing so much drums that you could hear all the chords and everything just in his drums. I mean, the sounds. I mean, sometimes he would have his drums tuned. He would play da 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 da. You know, they were tuned like different songs and stuff. Mm-hmm. He'd play, so you could hear all the music and the ways his drums were tuned. But every time we would, let's say we would play at the Village Vanguard, and then the next week McCoy's group would come in, with Sonny Fortune, but Elvin, we were working so much, we wouldn't be there in town. We'd be going out, because it was Tuesday through Sunday, and we'd play 3 sets a night. And the Monday we would travel to the next city. Mm-hmm. So of course McCoy was playing Tuesday through Sunday. That was it, and so I would miss them. But Alphonse Muzan came to the Vanguard one of these very various occasions I'm speaking of, and was telling me that McCoy and them were going to follow us in the next week. And of course, we had somewhere we were going to go play too. I forgot the city, but we were going to be out of town. But he came down, and after we played, he said, oh man, I'm going to tell McCoy that you have the sound we need. Oh, man, we need to get you in the group. That's what's going on. So I was like, oh wow. So he said, would you come down and, sit in, and he would arrange it. I said, man, I'm not going to be in town, but I appreciate the offer. But anyhow, something happened. It was a call that Elvin got, and the gig got canceled the next week. So I went down, and as soon as I walked in, Alphonse said, oh, man, meet McCoy. So I met him, and he said, oh, you want to play? You feel like playing? I said, yes, I do. By the way, so it was funny. I said, yeah, I think I do, as a matter of fact. So I had no idea what key the song was on or anything. He just started playing. I was standing up there, and Sonny Fortune, I asked Sonny, I said, what key is it in? He put his hands up in his fingers up, made a C. So, I don't know, that C, in my key is C in concert. But anyhow, so I soloed, man, and I just happened to have a good night. And afterwards, he went over to me and said, hey, buddy, you want to, you like playing? I said, yeah, that's what I'm out here doing. That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. So he said, okay, give me a number of stuff. And the next day, I was living in Virginia part-time. So I went to Virginia, and then they said, "Azo, you got a telephone call." And when I got on the phone, he said, "Hey, buddy, it's McCoy." Well, I must have, I may still be screaming. I was screaming so loud and so long, you know, that McCoy had called me and he invited me to join the group.
Yeah, yeah. So how did the transition go from Elvin's band to McCoy's? Did you, like, let those two guys work it out, or what was the...
I spoke to Elvin, and he cried, you know, he had, you know, I don't know, oh, man. He said, "Well, you gotta go, huh?" I said, "Yeah, I gotta go." So
yeah.
We sobbed a little bit and hugged and stuff, and then McCoy helped me get an apartment, you know. And so next thing you know, we played up, man, we played at this place in Syracuse, New York, upstate, and when I got on the airplane, man, I said, "Wow, that looks like Yusef Lateef." Alpha said, "Yeah, that is Yusef." I was like, "Oh, man, he was one of my idols, Yusef Lateef." I didn't say anything. I just, you know, tiptoed by him. And then, so after he played first, and so then we played. And after I was in the dressing room with McCoy getting packed up, he ran, came, busted the door, bam, and ran in there. I was like, "Oh, city," ran toward me. And then he stopped and said, "Do you know what you did? Do you know what you did?" I said, "What did I do? What did I do?" I thought something had happened wrong or something. He was like, "No, you got to the people. You got to the people through consistency." Oh, man, I was like, wow. Once again, I was just all, it was just a tearful moment. I was like, oh, man. And he said, "Anything I can do?" I said, "Well, man, I'd love to study with you." He said, "Well, okay, on an exchange basis, you know, you give me something, I'll give you something. You know, give me some knowledge." I'm like, "What can I? Well, whatever I can give, I will." So I studied with him. And then after that, the next performance was in Montreal, Switzerland. Not Montreal. We were in Kongsberg, Norway, the land of the midnight sun.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it was quite... I'll throw you off balance a little bit. At 11 p.m., the sun would go down to about like a sunset. And then back at 2 a.m., it was back up like noon. And that's where he showed me the song. Around 4 o'clock in the morning, he called me, 3 or 4 in the morning, and asked me, you know, come, you know, if I felt like playing. Of course I do. And we met him downstairs where there was a piano in a little room, you know, well, like a banquet room. And he showed me the songs that 2 days later would be on the songs for the Enlightenment album.
See, that was what I was curious about, was because McCoy, you know, on both of the live albums you did with him, on Enlightenment and then on Atlantis, you were playing all new material, like not stuff from the previous albums. So was he presenting new music to you guys all the time?
Mostly just for the recordings, but then we would play. But notice I said he, and you're correct, he presented the music to us the day before the performance, and it wasn't written. It was just all, you know, you had to retain whatever it was a test of retention of memory. And so we played it that morning. Then he showed me. Then the group came down around 7 in the morning. And then we played it as a group for an hour or two. And then we got on an airplane. I went to Paris to try to get a saxophone. I was going to, you know, I'm over there now. Let me get, you know, pick up a horn, go through the factory and all that. But it was August, and so I didn't realize that meant that everything was on holiday. Everyone was on holiday. The factory was closed. So then I met them back at the sound check in Montreal, and we played a few of the songs again.
Mm-hmm.
And that night we recorded.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I know I've read that you were talking about how there were a bunch of people, like, in the audience, like other musicians, watching you guys play.
So
I'm wondering about that Montreux Festival. I've always wondered if Miles was one of the people that was watching, because then 8 months later, you were with him at Carnegie Hall. So, like, was that where the connection was made? Or?
Well, I think that was definitely... He was there. He was there, and, well, I mean, on... Sonny Stitt, Gene Ammons, Cannonball Adderley, oh man, Cannonball, man, you name it, Gato by Barry. I mean, that's just the horn players. I mean, the trumpet players, Nat Adderley, Miles, they were all, everybody that was anybody was there. So when I came to walk on stage, you had, there was like about three or four steps up from the room in the back to the stage. And as I walked past, I walked past Dizzy Gillespie and Sonny Stitt, and they like patted me on the back, yeah, go get him, go. I was like, oh man, oh Lord, that was just almost, you know, I mean, you had to really have some courage with those guys. So then after I got past them and got up on stage with Junie Booth and Alphonse and McCoy and myself, when I looked out in the audience, and then Bobby Hutcherson and Willie Shaw were in the front row. Yeah, that was unbelievable. Then, of course, you know, now you got to remember the music, right? So, but yeah, I mean, everybody was there. And then McCoy, after we finished, he got up off the thing you know, they were still announcing us, and he ran over to me in the middle. I was like, oh man, that was my best. It was his best performance. He said, it was the best performance I've ever had. I was like, for real? Hey, he just ran over to me and hugged me. Oh man, Azar, that was the best performance. So anyway, those are some high points.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm curious about the whole Miles thing, because you and Dominique Gaumont, the guitarist, were both brought in for that one show, like sort of auditioning live on stage. So how did that come together, and how did the rest of his band feel about it? Because I'm wondering if he was, you know, if he was having trouble.
I don't remember Dominic. I remember Pete Cozy on guitar, Reggie Lucas on guitar, my boy, the bass player, what was his name? I can't think of him. Entume, and on congas, and percussion.
Michael Henderson was the bass player.
Michael Henderson, bass. And Miles was playing organ. Oh boy, it was funny. Yeah, he played, you know. But yeah, I did other stuff with him. It's just and I don't remember Dominic. Maybe Dominic played a couple of things, because I don't remember, you know. It was like a rock and roll show.
There
was the stacks of Marshall amps. It was so loud. It was like, you know, and then the organ, I mean, it was like, ooh, it was. And then, played, my horn didn't have, Dave Liebman was actually there too. And Miles was replacing Liebman with me. And Liebman had his horn, had a mic on it, you know, a pickup built into the horn. And mine, I was playing into the, when the, was for me to play. I was like all up in the microphone, but somebody tapped me on the back while I was playing, and I looked back, and it was Miles standing there. He had taken Liebman's horn from him. Oh, it was funny. He had taken Liebman's horn from him, and he was standing there with it outreached arms. You know, he had both his arms and had it laid across his arms, like, you know, I was presenting it to me. Oh boy, it was funny.
Man.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
So, but you wound up not joining that band. Do you think that was, like, do you think staying with McCoy gave you more sort of time in the spotlight than joining Miles' band would have been? Because Miles, it seemed like, was after, like, kind of a collective sound rather than that many, you know, traditional jazz-type solos. It was sort of everybody roaring at once, kind of like you were saying.
Yeah. No, Miles, we did a few things. And he asked me to join the band and go to Brazil with him and this, that, and I really wanted to go to Brazil, too. It's just, he wasn't really my kind of guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some guy, he just reminded me of a family member. The first thing was when I got down there before that, I didn't even play, because I had a gig with McCoy that night back in New York, and we went down, he was playing in D.C. I said, you think I can make it, man? He said, yeah, you can make it. So I thought, okay, that's it. So because we were playing McCoy, we were playing at a place called the East, which was like a cultural center, and all the brothers and sisters and the health foods, and it was a big. But it started later. It started at 10, not at 9. Mm-hmm. And so the last Eastern shuttle back to New York left at 9. You know, it was a shuttle that went back and forth. And so, you know, I figured, boom. And the gig got started at 8. Miles said, just come down and play one song. So I, you know, okay. So I got down there. But he wanted me to come to the hotel. And by the time I got there, it was close to 8. So I said, let me go on over to the club. So I got to the club. When he showed up, he said, oh, yeah, I was waiting on you. So, all right. So, but the limo driver said, oh, there's some detours. We're going to make the 9 o'clock show. We better get out of here. So I went in there and told him, you know, hey, man, you know, I got to split, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't know he was there the next night because I could have come back the next night. But at any rate, he said, well, come on and play one note. And he said, come and play one note. He said, come on and play one note. And so we were walking through the audience, and I was trying to tell him. So then I said, well, man, I can't do it, man. I said, if I was in your band, then I would make sure I was at your gig. And I'm in McCoy's band, I would make sure I'm there at his. I'm not going to leave him hanging. So because there ain't no way to get back, you know, unless I do this. So
yeah.
He said, if you don't play, I'm going to knock you out. And so that's when I put my stuff down, because I'm from the east side of Los Angeles, and we used to have to fight just to go to the store. So, you know, there was a gang right down the street. Yeah, they ask you if you had any money, and you know, they know you're going to the store, and your mother then gave you some money. And then, so at any rate, though, when he said that, I was like, oh, well, I guess I'm going to go down in history books one way or another, it looks like. Fighting with Miles at the club. So Toomey yelled on stage, he said, don't worry, that's his joke. But anyway, so I just went on, got in the limo, and made it on back. And I had left my car at the airport at you know, LaGuardia, and so I could jump in it and go on out to the Brooklyn, where the yeah. gig was. And yeah. And I when I got to the gig, McCoy pulled up at the same time. So I was like, yeah, that's a plan that came. But anyway, though, then they called me to do the other stuff, you know, and he really wanted me to join the band. And, you know, but it, you know, that knock you out stuff, I ain't with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't even play with me like that. So that turned me off, and, you know, I know somebody else that was like that, you know. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't want to work with assholes. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I mean, you know, and I'm sure he was cool, but I just, we didn't get past that, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you.
You know what I'm saying? You know, but anyway, that's.
So
no, you know, musically, I learned about just each time, you know, it was 40 years of experience would drip off of him onto me.
Mm-hmm.
Each time we played, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
now your record, Bridge into the New Age, was reissued last year. And that was really unlike anything that you had done before that with McCoy or with anybody else. So how did that record come together? Like, how long were you working on that material?
Well, actually, material just came together for the performance.
Mm-hmm.
I had written The Beautiful and Omnipresent Love prior to that, but the other songs, Bridge to the New Age, just, you know, a couple of months. The space was like that. It was, you know, a couple of months before that. One of the songs, like I said, the Beautiful and Omnipresent Love I had written the concept, had written that you know, about a year before that.
And I'm curious about some of the players on that, because you mentioned that you knew Arthur Blythe from Horace Tapscott's band. And he was
yes.
on that record. So what was your impression of his work at the time? Because it always seems to me like he was doing new things, but he was also going way back and pulling ideas from jazz's past in a way, you know? And I feel like that was true even later in his work, like when he was bringing in tuba players and stuff. So, I mean, how did he fit with, you know, how did you guys fit together creatively?
Well, Arthur Blythe was just such a prolific mentor. I mean, I would go to his house. I studied with Arthur. I mean, Arthur, that voice he had on his alto, I mean, I was just blessing just to perform on stage and be able to hear that voice right there. And it's just like being with McCoy or an Elvin. Those are voice, you know, the voice, just to hear the expression and the, you know, the flavor of the voice, of the sound, of the tone that they're emanating, you know, does something to you. And then, like, you know, McCoy told me, you know, when I was talking to him about John Coltrane, he said, well, I can tell you, I do know what a tenor saxophone is supposed to sound like. Well, I know what an alto saxophone is supposed to sound like, a piano, and I know what a drum's supposed to sound like too, and bass, you know, like from working with Jimmy Garrison, Ron Carter, and all those people. But yeah, so Arthur was a voice, and he was a very beautiful, humble individual, and I called him friend. We were friends, and he shared many things that prepared me. Just the way the whole setup, my whole my mouthpiece reed setup, all of that was influenced by Arthur at the time. You know, at that time, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Arthur was very knowledgeable about tenor saxophones, the difference that, you know, the different approach as far as practicing to master the tenor saxophone. In comparison to the alto, which is an easier instrument to actually perform to play.
Oh yeah.
Physically, that was my first instrument. But I played baritone in the Horace Tapscott Orchestra.
Uh huh.
You know, and the orchestra. No, it's not an orchestra. It was an arch, that, you know, like the Noah's Ark. That was the concept of orchestra.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the arch, I played baritone. Because they had the great Will Cornell was playing alto, rest his soul, and Arthur, you know, Guido Sinclair from Chicago. These are names probably people haven't heard of, but these guys, this guy, man, he was just one step from being Charlie Parker himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel like the orchestra and Tapscott's work in general kind of gets overlooked by jazz history in a way, because of being in LA or because of, you know, just like not having label interest, or I don't know what it is, but it's like it's a whole lost kind of history.
Yeah, I think it's all of that you mentioned, all of the above, you know. Yeah, for sure. Being in LA, you know, and and I think we did some recording. Yeah, we did do some recording. But, you know, that's as far as that I know it went.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Now,
everything was, it was underground. It was an underground organization, so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, you also had Woody Shaw on Bridge into the New Age, and then right around that same time, you were on his record, The Moon Train. So,
that's correct.
How do you think your saxophone style and his trumpet style blended together? Because he was a really, like, a strong, you know, kind of technical master of the trumpet in a lot of ways, you know?
True.
So.
Well, in Los Angeles, a couple of years before that, there was a group that I performed with, Larry Gales, the bass player from Thelonious Monk, Candy Finch, the drummer he had spent 5 years with Dizzy Gillespie,
mm-hmm.
George Cables, the pianist, Woody Shaw, and myself were in, and we performed every week at Larry Gales and Candy Finch had a club.
Oh, okay.
We'd perform after hours. So I was working with the newly formed group that would become War. Yeah, three or four times with Eric Burton from the Animals.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was with them. I'd rehearse with the Walk on the Third Street band during the day, getting ready to perform. And then Eric Burton, after a couple of rehearsals, put me on retainer, and I would just go pick up a check every Friday while he got the group together, got more different people. So then Tuesday and Thursday, from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., we'd perform.
Wow.
In the club.
Late night shows.
Mm-hmm. After hours.
Yeah, yeah.
So I played with Woody. Woody and I had performed. That's why I used him on Bridge into the New Age. And, you know, just phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those people, Joe Bonner, the pianist that's on that album, Bridge into the New Age, that was performing with Pharoah Sanders, and Clint Houston, the bass player, was also performing with Pharoah. So I saw them perform with him, and I was like, oh, I got to get them.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy Hart, when I first got to New York, and when I transitioned to McCoy Tyner's group, the first time we performed at the Village Vanguard, the club was overpacked. There was a line out the door. Up to everybody came down to see who I was. That McCoy Tyner skipped over all the musicians that were standing in line to get that gig, and hired me from L.A., which to them was the country. You know.
Yeah, they
were like, "Who in the heck is this cat?" You know, they wanted to come down to see. You know. So that's where I met Billy Hart. And Billy Hart, you know, came up to me and told me, you know, man, hey, man, a lot of cats trying to find out what's going on with you, man. That's why it's so packed. You know, all the musicians, everybody was there to see who this was. And so, he, you know, Billy and I became friends. And he said, somebody has to be your family. And so I started going over to his place for Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Yeah.
So that's why he got on the, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And then he eventually, you know, after Alphonse and Alphonse left, then McCoy, we went through quite a few different configurations of bass and drums. Billy Hart, Buster Williams, Cabo, what's his? I mean, everybody. Other than we, only one that didn't play with us was Tony Williams. Everybody else, Lewis Hayes on drums. I mean, Cecil McBee. I mean, everybody. I can't even think of all. I mean, we went through everyone in New York of the top guys. So, but so I had a chance to play with Billy for a while there too. I mean, that's how all of that kind of stuff, you know, happened.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm curious about your ties to Earth, Wind, and Fire, because some of those guys were on a Gene Harris album that you were on. And then on your album, People Moving, there's versions of Can't Hide Love and Gratitude. And then
right. You
actually joined Earth, Wind, and Fire for the Powerlight record, I think, right? You wrote three songs on that record. So how did all this kind of come together?
Well, you know, interesting enough, I was on his albums in New York, and I started using him on all my albums. So we were flying back. We both lived in Jersey. We'd fly into Berkeley to do my album. And then one of the times, he was flying back to his family, and so would I usually, but I have family in L.A., my parents, so. But he came down, he needed to come to L.A. To do Earth, Wind, and Fire album. He's recorded with him on quite a few albums.
Uh-huh.
And so I went with him, and he introduced me to Maurice White. And Maurice already knew who I was. And then later, this guy named Ernest Strotter, who the Strotter brothers, who worked on Bridge into the New Age, and worked, I know them from the Horace Tapscott organization.
Mm-hmm.
Ernest, a good friend, introduced me to Skip Scarborough, who wrote Can't Hide Love, and Love Ballad, and Don't Ask My Neighbor, a lot of hits.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, Skip was a hit songwriter. So I went over, when I was getting ready to do People Moving, I went to his house, and he was playing, he played Can't Hide Love on piano for me, and the chords sound like McCoy. I mean, he was playing those kind of, he sounded like McCoy. I was like, oh, okay, we got to work together. We got to do this. So, yeah, it was the same texture. So that's how he got involved. And Maurice was going to have said that he was going to write the liner notes, you know, which would have been, you know, huge in terms of airplay, you know, I mean, you know, his name on it and all that. And what happened is when it was came time after the album was done, it came time to do it. Their co-producer or slash arranger, Charles Stephanie, had passed, and they were in a disarray. Oh boy, I went to the studio with to see Maurice, and boy, he was just down in the dumps, and everybody there, it was just a sad day. They wasn't like the same group of people I just had met. They were all boy. He didn't end up writing the thing, and you know, and that's how that album came. Skip Scarborough produced it, and that was why we used Gratitude and you know, all of that.
Yeah, and then like I said, a few years later, you were on their album Power Light. Like, you wrote three songs, but you weren't playing sax; you were playing a synth, I think.
So... Yeah, I was playing the synth bass. Well, I had a. I had my company up and running where I was writing a song a day to keep me on the way, on the way to the bank, that is. That was my little motto, a hit song a day, keep you on the way to the bank. So, I was writing, I had a guy named Greg Cook that was a very good keyboardist and a bass player, a guitar player. So I used him to play guitar and bass, and he co-wrote a lot of songs, but I wrote a lot myself. So the songs I used on the Earth, Wind & Fire album, what happened is I was had taken my daughter and her mother up to the Peak Fair. It was off of Fairfax and Beverly. It was a theater, and I had this girl named Chocolate from Grand Central Station, Patrice Banks. I knew her, and she called me and said, oh, I want to bring somebody by. And so this is before this. So she came by and introduced me to Chuck Jackson. Chuck Jackson produced all of Natalie Cole's hits.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, he was a singer himself. And so I lived in Baldwin Hills, and he lived around the corner somewhere up in there. And so she brought him by to hear some of my songs because I was just cataloging, writing songs every day. That was all I was doing, writing songs. I had a four-track TAC, the cassette. Well, there was a new technology, like a multi-track recorder. You know, you had four tracks, you could do all of that. Anyway, so I had a synthesizer. And, I was writing every day. He came by, and he was like, oh, man. He loved the stuff, and he was one of the most workingest producers in Los Angeles. And so he would come by and take four or five songs of mine, and he and Patrice would write lyrics or whatever, and we were a team. And they, I'd have four songs and on each one of his albums. We did Family Turrentine album, Ren Woods, Irene Carr. We did a bunch of people. The list went on, and then I'm not a keyboard player, but if you need a hit song, I can create an environment on the keyboard for you to, prosper.
Right.
So, yeah. So, but they, I had a little signature somehow when I write a song made it. He wanted me to play, so I played on the songs, and I'd have like at least four songs on each one of those albums, and. I was listening. I was sitting at the theater in my car, and then behind me, this porch pulled up, and I was sitting there listening to songs, and I saw Maurice. I was like, oh, wow, I jumped out, Maurice. What's up, man? He said, oh, man, I'm glad I see you. I'm seeing you. He said, I just took the group to Egypt, and, man, I stumbled upon so many different things in there. I need to talk to someone that understands. And spiritually, he and I shared some of the same philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him, well, look, man, I'm, you know, shucks. He was taking his daughter to the movie. And my daughter and her mother were in the movie. So I was waiting on them to come out. But I told him, I said, man, I wanted to play some, I'm writing and I got some stuff. He said, oh, yeah. He said, well, look, man, Ken, you want to come by later on tonight? I said, yeah. He said, I want to talk to you about this Egyptian stuff and you can play the music. I said, that's great. He said, it's going to be late. I said, okay. So I gave him my number and he said, I'll call you when I'm back. He said, you know, he had some dinner meetings and stuff. So about 12:30 or 1 o'clock, I get a call. It was him. And he said, well, are you asleep or you want to come? I said, no, I'm on the way. So I went up there and so he said, well, let's get this music stuff out of the way. Because they thought I was, you know, all they thought about is thought about me was John Coltrane. That's all they didn't know I had a funk background.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, let's play the stuff and let's get that out of the way so we can talk to them about the Egyptian stuff. I said, okay. So we played that and he listened. He played it back, the first song back. He said, man, I'm hearing something on this. I'm hearing something. I was like, wow, he said, play the next one. So he played the next one in the studio. Man, I'm hearing something. Man, I'm hearing something. I'm hearing. He said, can you leave these with me? I said, oh, absolutely. Shoot. So I said, well, I got a third one. I got another one, but I didn't bring it. He said, oh, man. And you know, we didn't ever talk about Egypt. You know, I went on home. It was like 3 in the morning. So he said, can you call me tomorrow and play that for me? Now, you know, it's like rare that you can play a song for someone of that stature on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sure. He said, call me at noon. So I called him at noon, and he said, man, can I hear the song? Can I hear the song? And I played it for him. And, man, I still remember this day. It was so sweet the way he said, can I have that one too? I was like, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely, my brother. You can have it. I'm on the way.
Yeah. Let's see,
where are you? Yeah, if I had known where he was at, I wouldn't even have heard the last words. I would have just been in the car driving already. Yeah, so we got up there, and then, but it was funny because later he was telling me, yeah, he said, you know, between you and me, he said, when I play, when I told the guys in the group that, you know, I had three songs from you, they laughed and said, what is it going to be, a tribute to John Coltrane? That was funny. But at any rate, yeah, that's how that happened. And, you know, and I gave him three songs, and he's, you know, up until the day before the listening party, just one song, he kept saying, yeah, he said, man, you know, I heard two of them, but the other one, he said, man, a week before, he rewritten the lyrics. Then that week, he said, I rewrote the lyrics. Then the day before, he told me, he said, yeah, man, I rewrote the lyrics again. I was like, oh, okay. So, when we got to the listening party, I knew I had two songs. And Larry Dunn told me, he said, yeah, man, he said, I know something you don't know. I said, is that right? So then the first song that came played was the third song, Spread Your Love. And I didn't know what he had done with, you know, I thought that was going to be on it. Yeah. It was such a thrill.
Wow. Anyway, it's so interesting to me, like, that period in the mid-70s where everything seemed to be kind of blending together, like soul and funk and jazz, and, you know, like a band like Earth, Wind & Fire, really, they had the funk thing going and they had the ballads, but then they also really had that jazz influence. And it seems like all the musicians were kind of crossing from one world to another, because, you know, you and Pharoah and Archie Shepp and guys like that were doing the same thing, like, in, you know, bringing in elements of all these different sounds.
Right.
So, I mean, what was your take on that? Was that just like an open-mindedness that, you know, isn't really there anymore? Or what, you know, what do you think?
Well, you mean holistically I feel very open-minded. In fact, some of the stuff that I'm doing reflects the open-mindedness of it. Because, you know, the whole thing is all these rhythms came out of Africa. So I have no problem. And I'm also encouraged and inspired to use all the various rhythms, you know, world rhythms. I'm not locked in. So if you listen to some of the records that Views have created just recently, and, you know, The Seeker and you know, it's not a lot of the swing. And when you hear this Elementals disc that we're very proud of that's coming out March 1st, then I think you'll see, you know, quite a compilation of different world rhythms, and including some swing, but it's, the swing is not the majority of rhythmic features on Elementals. And you know, speaking of which, that the Elementals concept is something that is some of the things I was saying, you know, philosophy-wise, philosophically, shared with Maurice and others, you know, of that like-minded, and just to know that the it's not elements, it's the Elementals are speaking of the nature spirits, the spirits that correspond to each one of the elements, the natural elements, earth, wind, fire, water, those each have a corresponding beings that govern and operate out of those textures and dimensions, you know. So we're just kind of giving, paying tribute to the Elementals and their work, how it all ties into how life is operating here.
Now, I want to ask actually about a couple of records that you did a few years ago. Because with your record "Prayer for My Ancestors," that was that a reunion with Alphonse Mouzon for you? Was that the first time you guys had played together in a while?
No, we had played together. Well, it was in a period where we had just kind of hooked back up. But Alphonse and I played together in a few of my performances that he was he joined me once we found out that we were out here together. You know. We started joining forces, and so yeah, no, he had performed with me, but that was the first time he had recorded with me since McCoy. So yeah, "Prayer for My Ancestors," Nate Morgan, rest his soul. I grew up with Nate Morgan, the pianist, and interesting enough, Nate was the original pianist from the Shafiq Khan and Rufus group.
So yeah, that's, again, it's one of those things where all these worlds kind of collide, you know.
Exactly.
And yeah, the that record I thought was interesting because it had that blend of, you know, jazz and the more and like more African music. Have you done a lot of like formal study of African music and music from other parts of the world, or do you just kind of, you know, pick things up here and there, or, you know?
No, it's all been a study, actually, since the early 70s, I mean, and late 60s. I mean, you know, became more intense as time went on. And then I had a chance to explore those places, you know.
Yeah. And I'm also curious about your album Mystic Journey, which is from around the same time period, because you, you did some older tunes on that one. You reworked your song Summer Solstice, and you also redid Walk Spirit, Talk Spirit, which was the one you did with McCoy. So when you're revisiting an older song like that, what are you looking to bring out of it?
Well, it has more in it. We didn't get all, we didn't get it all out. We didn't get it all out, you know. We didn't express everything. You know, there's still a pot of gold that needs to be expressed within it. That's what, you know, and that was our, you know, and then also a tribute to that song, you know, to McCoy, you know, and his mentorship, and to so many, and his providing such upliftment in his musical career to everyone, you know, that has been touched by it. And then also the fact that, you know, he's redone it a few times with Freddie Hubbard and some others, but it just didn't seem like it had, you know, expressed what we got out of it the very first time. So
Now in 2005 you took part in the Gathering project, the Lyffert Park record, and You were on the same. You were on a track from that album alongside Kamasi Washington, who was, you know, a young guy at that point, and has in the last couple of years he's kind of popped up and, you know, made a real name for himself. So what was your impression of him as a player back then?
Well, I think he's always been a great player. He's his father and I went to school together. His father's a great player too. Saxophone has tremendous flute sound. Kamasi worked hard and works hard, and you know, I think that he's done well. You know, was patient and studied, and I'm glad things are working because it helps us. You know, it's all one big pot, and you know, it helps us all. Everybody's helped. You know, my thing helped my time. Previous time was a link that helped him and others, and as we're doing, even as we speak, we're still helping each other. We're all helping each other.
And again, it was another, he was, you know, able to kind of sort of wave the flag for Los Angeles again, you know?
Exactly, in a big way.
Yeah.
And then the Kendrick Lamar, which was a propulsion device for him being on his album for Kendrick. You know, that was a new kind of rap, hip-hop expression, and Kamasi and Terrence Martin were involved in that project, which, you know, gave them quite a lift. And I played the music on the release of the Bridge into the New Age, the re-release from Concord. We performed at a place called Zebulon. It was in Glendale here, or Frogtown as they call it. And Kendrick Lamar came and stayed the whole 2 hours we performed.
Wow, nice.
Yeah,
it seems like there's a real interest among younger listeners in the kind of music that you were doing on that record. You know, that kind of spiritual, you know, jazz that has elements of R&B and stuff like that. I mean, is that something that you're looking at, you know, exploring again in the future?
Well, yeah, when you that is for sure. In fact, the re-release of Bridge into the New Age was that we utilized that time to upgrade and put into effect the plans that we had been had been conceived just prior to that. It was the perfect time to upgrade our group. We have a 7-piece group now. Wendy Barnes is the vocalist. You know, we have, in other words, we have vocals, a vocalist, a female vocalist. We utilize the percussion, and just picking up where I left off.
Yeah.
You know, different circles. I tried different variations throughout the whole time in between here, just to it's all part of a an evolutionary spiral, and so that combination that was done, that I used and put together then in the production of that album, is now again, as the Aquarian energies, Aquarian age energies, as spiritual energies are becoming more heightened and more people are in touch with them, we answered the call from the Most High and from the universe, and have upgraded the group, and now it's time for us to express what we had previously expressed. Now it's time for it. It's time for the, you know, in terms of the way that people are needed now. So that's the sound that is best to express what we, you know, what we have to say. So, you know, I mean, elementals is various textures of that, you know, percussion, use some guitar vocals on a one track. But,
I feel like the reason I'm so interested in you and your career is that you've worked in so many different forms. You've done, you know, pure sort of hard bop stuff, and you've done fusion and funk and R&B. And I kind of feel like you're somebody that understands that jazz shouldn't be separate from other things, that it should be kind of considered one stream in the whole continuum of music.
I agree, and thank you. You know, Concord is also has scheduled a release of my Summer Solstice album.
Oh, that one's coming back out too? Nice.
Yeah, and the people moving, and over the next 2 or 3 years, and then we have an unreleased album. It's going to be a surprise that is coming forward too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's what we're trying to do is link, you know, the continuum of the expression of this art. You know, the way we perceive it, which has the fundamental spirituality. I mean, you know, if it's devoid of that, then it's not whole. You know, what is it doing? I mean, this way we have some kind of value in for your soul, you know, for the real soul music. And this is, you know, some music that is touching your soul and rejuvenating and, you know, inspiring one to listen to his inner voice or her inner voice, so that they don't have to utilize the words I wish I had them. I mean, but you know, if you listen to your inner voice, then you know the tiny voice that's whispering inside that you have to be quiet, silent, and be still to be in touch with. Then you know you can be proud of your decisions that you're making, because you're guided, you know, by the intelling force.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why we're targeting, you know, or staying in touch with the children and younger people, you know, all people.
Yeah.
Okay, that was my interview with Azar Lawrence. As I mentioned at the beginning, the Burning Ambulance podcast is now part of the Osiris Network, which is a great source for other music and culture podcasts. If you like us, go check out osirispod.com, and I'm sure you'll find other shows that will interest you too. Osiris also partners with Relics Magazine, so check out relics.com for music news, and thanks for listening. Hope to have you back the next time.